No, we're going to another side. This is the side B of tape 7. Justice Thomas E. Brennan, Roger Lane with him in his office. And today is February 14th, and we're nearing the end of the audio taping of Judge Brennan. Now, how about apportionment? We haven't had anything to do with apportionment yet.
Okay, I just got the case out, Roger, to sort of refresh my recollection. And the case that I participated in is in 387 Michigan at begins at 442. It was in re the apportionment of the legislature. And to set the scene, the situation was that the Constitution of the State of Michigan established an eight-member apportionment commission consisting of four Democrats and four Republicans. I'm not sure whether they were chosen by their respective parties or whether they were nominated by the governor.
But the parties.
By the parties? Well, in any case, they represented the two parties and the two major political parties. And their job was to come up with a new map of the state of Michigan showing the senatorial and legislative districts for the state of Michigan. Every 10 years when the census was taken, the commission met, and every 10 years the commission managed to stalemate, predictably, because of the split between four Republicans and four Democrats in the membership of the commission. They did so in 1972. Under the Constitution, if the commission was unable to agree on an apportionment plan, the members of the commission who had drafted proposed apportionment plans would take their plans to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, under the Constitution, would decide which of those plans most nearly conform to the constitutional requirements. What happened was that the Republicans and the Democrats both submitted plans to the Michigan Supreme Court. The Republican plan had a smaller ratio of a smaller divergence within the population of each of the districts than did the Democratic plan. The way these things were presented, the ratio was spelled out as 1.003 or 5 or 7, whatever, to 1. So, in effect, the largest district would be 3 or 5 or 9, 1/10,000 larger than the smallest district. Or maybe the average, I forget how that was calculated, but it was a very minimal standard. The court, during the course of the pendency of the litigation that came to us under the Constitution, allowed the Democratic side of the Apportionment Commission to amend their plan and to submit a new plan which had a still lower ratio of divergence among the population of the districts.
Now this happened, do I understand correctly, after the formal declaration of deadlock that triggered the court's role?
Exactly. It happened after the case had already been brought to the court. And if I'm not mistaken, it was some sort of an order allowing or permitting additional time or holding the case in abeyance while this was accomplished. The Democrats then came in with a report that had, in fact, a smaller numerical divergence factor. The Republicans then asked for time to revise their bid, their program, downward, I suppose, to see if they couldn't produce something that was even closer to a dead even. The court refused to give the Republicans time to do that. Having then done so, the court took under consideration the case and heard the arguments of counsel and concluded that our duty as a court to decide which plan most nearly conformed to the Constitution was a very mechanical duty. It was simply to look at the divergence ratios and pick the lowest one.
What did you call that? I think you had a phrase for that.
Well, I...
Doctrine of relative, was it? Or?
I had a phrase for the concept was somewhat what I called newborn constitutional concept of relative constitutionality, because the Constitution of 1963 said that the Supreme Court shall choose the plan which most nearly complies with the Constitution. The Supreme Court shall determine which plan complies most accurately with the constitutional requirements. That's what the Constitution said. And I said in my dissenting opinion that the Constitution seems to contemplate that we apply some newborn standard of relative constitutionality. And I went on to say, I never heard of one law being more constitutional than another. Constitutionality is like pregnancy. Either you is or you ain't. And that was the comment about relative constitutionality. But then I went on to say, nevertheless, that's our job. That's what the Constitution tells the court to do, so we have to try to do it. And then I conclude that, well, if you're going to pick the lowest bidder, the lowest population ratio, that's at least an objective standard that everyone can understand. It's easy to apply. It'll work. I pointed out that it doesn't mean anything. I mean, literally doesn't mean anything, because the ratio is so tiny, so minuscule, that either the census itself isn't that accurate, or even if the census were that accurate, just the normal change in people's residences that would occur in a matter of weeks and certainly months between the taking of the census and the we were dealing with the 1970 census, and this lawsuit was in 1972, so 2 years had gone by. There was no question at all that the districts as they existed out there in reality on the real estate in the state of Michigan, the people living in those districts were different from the numbers of people who were in the census in 1970. And certainly by substantial numbers as opposed to these tiny, tiny fractional differences. So it had no substantive reality to it. But it was still, if you're going to play games, it was a game you could play and it would be fair to everybody. Or it could be fair to everybody. Then I pointed out, okay, if what you're going to do is simply let the contract to the lowest bidder, if you're going to simply allow the political party that comes in with the lowest population ratio to set the districts, then at least you ought to take sealed bids. You ought to give both sides a chance to give it their best shot and go from there. And I suggested that if, in fact, they both came out with a perfect plan so that there was a ratio of 1-to-1, dead to even, that you would then refer to the number of political units of government that were divided in the apportionment plan and use that factor to break the ties. So what I was looking for, quite frankly, was a way for the court to be an impartial arbiter between the two divergent forces on that commission, to and simply to set some rules that applied to both of them that we could enforce impartially that would help them to get their job done and function on behalf of the people of the state of Michigan. Subsequent to that decision and in years since then, I developed a rather comprehensive approach to the apportionment problem, which built on what I said in my dissenting opinion. In other words, instead of a process whereby both parties would make a complete apportionment plan and then submit them in sealed bids, I had come up with an idea that a legislative districting map could be drawn seriatim in an adversary proceeding, so that you could, like you play a chess game, you could have one party draw the first district, and then the other party draw the next district, and pass the map back and forth between the two parties with certain time limits, like you would in an international chess match, and certain parameters of legality that would be established by the court. In other words, the court could say that the ratio shall not be more than 1 to 1.009 or 6 or whatever you wanted to do, and that the district must be contiguous to the district already on the map, or that the district cannot leave an island that is surrounded something. All various little rules that you would develop. You could even have a gerrymander rule that would prohibit a district from being too long or skinny or whatever. And ultimately achieve a map which was drawn through the adversary process, where the court's function would be to be the honest cop between the two political parties. That never caught on, and I'll tell you why I think, in my judgment, the drive for political power and the desire to control the machinery of government is so intense and overpowering that it sweeps almost all attempts to be nonpartisan out of the way. You just don't have Republicans or Democrats who want to have a fair system of apportionment. Active Republicans want the state apportioned to benefit the Republicans, and active Democrats want the state apportioned to benefit the Democrats. You can talk until you're blue in the face trying to get them to come together on a system which is fair to both. They don't want fairness. They want to win. And unfortunately, that win mentality infects the way they feel about the court. And so they conclude that the court's role as the arbiter or the ultimate authority in the area of apportionment, their conclusion was that the court was thrust into the Republican versus Democrat milieu. And they went out and elected people, nominated people to run for the Supreme Court, and they gave money to assist people to get elected to the Supreme Court on the basis that they wanted to have votes on the Supreme Court when it came to apportionment, because that decision would establish control of the legislature for the next 10 years. And you saw the Democratically nominated members of the court vote for the Democratic plan. Not only vote for the Democratic plan, but in my judgment, prostitute themselves by giving the Democrats one last chance to revise their plan before they heard the case. The Republicans weren't a whole lot better in terms of their chauvinism, because the sequel to this case I've cited in 387 Michigan was that the Republicans, having lost in the state Supreme Court, then went to the federal court in Detroit. And I think maybe John Fikens got the case, but it went to a federal district court judge in Detroit. And, I'm getting ahead of myself. Before they went to the federal court, they came back to our court with a petition to throw the whole commission out, with a petition to determine that the commission was unconstitutional. And you'll remember that argument ultimately carried the day in the 1980s.
It had one vote in that book that you've got open in front of you, and that was from T.G. Kavanaugh, and he paid dearly for it, remember, 4 years later.
To a degree, I think, yes, although it was not, I don't think that was the real thing that did it.
But he did take the position in that case.
Let me just review that for a moment.
That the commission was unconstitutional.
Yeah, he concluded, he said, we have no proper function at all in this matter. He says,
that was pretty big heresy.
Well, he quoted Justice Souris, who said in the 1964 case, having concluded that the apportionment and districting provisions for both the Senate and the House were violative of the 14th Amendment, it was my conclusion that Section 6, Article 4, which established the commission, likewise had to be held void. Section 6, in my view, was so dependent upon the continuing validity of the preceding sections by which the commission's duties were specified and expressly limited that it could not survive alone. So Souris had written in the 64 case that the commission should be thrown out. T.G. Kavanaugh agreed with him in 1972. So that opinion had been expressed at least on a couple of different occasions, and ultimately, as I say, carried the day. But after this decision was expressed, and now let's just flip back through the opinion for a half a moment and see where we were. After that opinion was expressed, we're talking of May of 1972, okay. Let's see. T.M. Kavanaugh, as Chief Justice, had written the majority opinion. Had Adams, Swainson, and Williams concurring, so he had four votes. Okay. The Republicans came back in after this case and wanted a rehearing, and wanted it on the basis that the commission should be thrown out. I don't know who they thought was going to change his mind. Unless they felt that if it got to be three against four, then maybe somebody would. I don't know.
Well, Adams was a short timer. wasn't it? He only had a few months to go in his term.
Yeah.
Could run again.
He had the rest of the year. It was
okay.
May.
Okay.
So he had the rest of that year. But in any case, they came back. They wanted the rehearing, and they wanted to get it on the basis that the commission ought to be thrown out. I voted to deny the rehearing.
You paid for that, didn't you? Didn't you? Weren't you, when you ran subsequently in the
for
primary?
For the United States Senate in 1976.
Weren't you denounced by some of your...
I was denounced, among others, by a man by the name of Keith Molin, who was a functionary of Governor Milliken, and and it was the first time it had ever dawned on me that there were people in the Republican Party who thought that I had done something bad by voting my conscience and my view of the law in a case. And I was pretty naive, I guess, not to realize that as far as the politicians were concerned, there's no such thing as judicial decisions. There are only favorable and unfavorable decisions as far as their interests are concerned.
Specifically in this subject area, right?
Oh yeah, and when you come to this thing, this was not even regarded as a judicial matter. This was, you know, who are you and where are you coming from? And that spec ogre was raised and talked about. I don't know that it made any difference. When you say I paid for it, I don't know that it made any difference in terms of the support I got from the Republicans. It might have. It's very possible, I suppose. But in any case, I made the decision that I did. They later went to the federal district court, and the feds also denied the petition.
Was it a split vote, you remember?
Out of Detroit.
Three judge court, 2-1?
Yeah, they must have gone to Cincinnati after
that,
and it may have been a split vote down there.
I think Ted Swift handled that, didn't he? I seem to remember something.
It's possible. It's possible. I don't know whether he was it. But anyway, that's the story with apportionment. It's never a pleasant bit of business because it's so political. And it always leaves scars in terms of the court and the relationship among the justices and so forth. Yes, I see that the Foster Swift firm represented some of the commissioners. It doesn't say Ted Swift. Peter F. McNenley was counsel. On the record, anyway, in the arguments in our court. Anyway, that was that. What else?
Well, just one last word on the apportionment. Now, in 82, this is, we're getting beyond your...
Could we turn it off just for a...
Well, I'm going to withdraw the suggestion about the 82 aspects of, or the 92, I mean, of apportionment.
Well, I believe it was July of 1980, a portrait of me was presented to the Michigan Supreme Court, and on that occasion, there were a number of speakers. I've embarrassed the president of the State Bar of Michigan, spoke on behalf of the bar. Lieutenant Governor Brickley spoke on behalf of the state of Michigan, I guess, and brought the greetings of Governor Bill Milliken. My son, Thomas E. Brennan Jr., spoke on behalf of the family, my family, introduced them all. Judge Richard M. Maher, who was then a judge of the Court of Appeals, was introduced, and he spoke about the years that he and I were in law practice together with several other people. And then Mike Devine, who was my administrative assistant when I was Chief Justice, spoke about those years and his recollections and some of the things that we had done and accomplished. And thereafter, Lewis A. Smith was introduced, and he spoke about the years that I was associated with the Thomas Cooley Law School. Finally, at the conclusion of that, the portrait was unveiled, and Justice Ryan commented on behalf of the court with respect to the portrait and my being there. And finally, I was given an opportunity to say a few words on the record. I made the comment that I had never known of an Irish wake where the corpse got up and spoke. And I also said that I confessed that I was somewhat amused to fancy myself to be the youngest ghost to haunt the bench and bar. I had been called the youngest Chief Justice in the history of the state and so forth, so I found myself being the youngest ghost to haunt the bench and bar. I also made the comment that it was particularly flattering to realize that I was the only living former Chief Justice whose picture was being hung in the court chambers. I had presided at the last session of the Supreme Court in the old Capitol and on the third floor, and I also presided as Chief Justice in the first session of the Supreme Court in its present quarters in the law building. So I had, as I mentioned, a special affinity for that place. I concluded my comments with a paragraph that I have read and reread a number of times and thought so often how well it expresses my feelings about my own life. You have to remember that I was 31 when I was elected to the Common Pleas Court. I was 33 when I was appointed to the Circuit Court. I was 37 when I was elected to the Supreme Court. 39 when I was made Chief Justice. And, only 43, I guess, or 44, when I resigned from the court to start the law school. And when I was elected to the Supreme Court at the age of 37, my friend Dick Smith from Bay City called me up the night of the election. He said, "Well, now remember, Tommy, my boy, early ripe, early rot." And I thought about that. But anyway, against that background of having risen to the top, what is, I suppose, the top of our profession in this state, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, at the tender age of 39, I said this: "I cannot sit down without a public acknowledgement of my gratitude to Almighty God for the life He has given me. To have lived in the United States of America in the middle of the 20th century, of all nations and of all times, the most hospitable to freedom, progress, and human happiness, to have been born and to have resided in the state of Michigan, of all places on this earth, the most beautiful and bountiful, inhabited by good and decent people, alive with activity and beaming with hope and opportunity. To have been blessed with loving parents, a devoted wife and children, caring teachers, stimulating colleagues, trusted counselors, and loyal friends. To have been privileged to read the law, that jealous mistress of the intellect, which teases the mind with truths half revealed, logic tempered by experience, and the promise of touching from time to fleeting time the incomprehensible form of justice itself. To have enjoyed the incomparable gift of time in such abundance of event-filled days and hours that I can stand here today listening to the echo of my own footsteps. These unearned blessings have come at the hand of a generous Creator, not through any merit of mine, but through His grace and to suit His purpose, which it shall ever be my goal to serve as best I can. You know, I think sometimes as I reread that and try to give it the feeling, the sense of involvement that I had at the time I wrote it, that it would do me well to read that every day. It would do me well to remind myself of how blessed I am and how happy I ought to be, content I am, ought to be. But it's funny. I've gone on to do a lot of different things. Started the law school. I've been busy here now for 17, 18 years. In the process, I had lots of flirtations with different things. I was involved with the Committee for Constitutional Reform, and I chased that butterfly for a while. I ran for the United States Senate. I ran for Lieutenant Governor, which was the craziest thing I ever did. After having achieved what I had achieved, to kind of go back, I might as well run for dog catcher when I didn't think about it. But I've in the last few years gotten involved in computers of all crazy things. Have learned a lot about the whole business of electronic communication and what those machines are capable of doing. But one of the things I did with the computer, just sort of fun, was I created a little program which I called Mood Check. And the Mood Check is a thing that I did at first just sort of to tease my wife a little bit. But I listed a whole bunch of words, everyone having either a positive or a negative connotation, and I tried to set them in pairs. So I had on and off, up and down, in and out, happy, unhappy, fat, thin, pressured, relaxed, all of these different words. And then I scattered them so that the opposites did not pair up as you saw the list. And then I created this program which asks the reader and operator of the computer to punch a key representing 0 to 9 as you feel that word describes your mood at the moment. So if you see the word unhappy, and unhappy describes exactly the way you feel, you give it a 9. If it doesn't describe the way you feel at all, you give it a 0. If you're a little unhappy, you might give it a 2 or a 3. If you're not very unhappy at all, you might give it a 7 or an 8. So, and just do it quickly and sort of responsively as these words flash on the screen. And then I have a calculation built into the computer program which will take all of your positive responses and divide them into the difference between your positive responses and your negative responses. So that if every response you make is a positive response, let's say you have And it doesn't make any difference whether you score it 3 or 9. What really matters is whether is the ratio of the difference to the total. So, if, for example, your positive points total 180, and the difference between your negative points and your positive points is also 180, so so you gave a zero to every negative word, you would get 100%. And so you're feeling, your mood is 100%. You couldn't feel better. You feel great.
Top of the world.
Top of the world. But every time you shade it, every time you come in, you say you're a little unhappy or a little this or a little that, it comes down. Now, I've run this thing with some of our employees around the school here. I've run it with members of my family, and it's fascinating to see what kind of numbers people get. The happiest people, the most positive, get the job done, do it cheerfully, agreeable, etc. sort of folks. My secretary one, for example, had a 93% or 91%. Stephanie Gregg, our director of admissions, who was a very positive, very warm, outgoing person, and who, one of the things we wanted in an admissions office, somebody who made an excellent, friendly impression with people. She got a 93. My daughter-in-law, 91 or 92, Tom's wife, she's one of these bubbly people who's just always get the job done, can do, never too busy to run an errand for you or do whatever you ask her to do or so forth. On the other hand, some people who work here have gotten some very unhappy scores. There's a lady here whose husband is in prison, has an elderly, invalid mother living with her, dependent upon her, a teenage daughter who's pregnant, a teenage son who's kind of unemployed and so forth, dependent on her. She's deeply in debt, etc. She took the test and did so poorly on it, she didn't even leave it on the machine. She took it off the computer. Reputedly, I heard from other people, because this wasn't an exercise that the employees were required to do. We were just sort of doing it for fun. But I heard from other people that her score was a minus 25. So she really, I mean, it's unhappy. But other people, 59 here, 28 here, and different scores. And as I began to match them up, I say, well, yeah, some of these folks aren't too happy. My score, and it doesn't seem to make any difference what my mood is or how I try to fool a machine, if I get into it and I take the thing with any sort of integrity at all, my score will invariably be between 65 and 70. I'm about two-thirds happy. Even today, I'm about two-thirds happy. And I look at the other people around the office and in the family who score about as I do. And my sense of it is that there's a little antsiness, fidgetiness about us, that there's more to be done, there's something going on. Sometimes I'll be driving with my wife and tapping my hands on the steering wheel of the car. And she says, "Can't you just relax? Calm down, you know?" And because my mind is going a million miles an hour, I'm thinking, I'm a person who doesn't sleep very, very well. Like last night, I was probably awake off and on 2 or 3 hours during the course of an 8-hour period in bed, go to bed. But I'll wake and if sleep fitfully, then I'll be thinking of things during the night. Sometimes get up and write speeches or letters during the night. Or make do lists for the next day, things that I want to do to remind myself. And when I see a list of words and I see the word unsatisfied, I know that unsatisfied is a negative word. I put it in there as a negative word. You're not supposed to be unsatisfied. You're supposed to be satisfied. If you're happy, you're satisfied. You're unhappy if you're unsatisfied. And every time I see that word, I say to myself, yes, I'm unsatisfied on a lot of things, and I don't think that's so bad to be unsatisfied. I'm going to give myself a 4 or a 6, you know. So I think the sense of being incomplete, unfinished, sort of antsy, there's work to be done, there's something to be accomplished, not a bad sense. And really, in terms of real human happiness, I think it probably is an important factor. And without backing away from one whit or comma of what I said to the court in 1980, that I am thankful to the Lord for all of the blessings I've had. And I think one of the blessings is to be a little unsatisfied.
This marks the end of the Brennan tapes, particularly tape 7B.